Chief Judge of the Judges of the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. Hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals draw near, for the court is now in session. God save the United States and His Honorable Court.
Please take your seats. Are both sides ready to argue?
Yes, Your Honor.
I am, Your Honor.
Does any side wish to have any in reserve?
Yes, Your Honor, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
All right, you may proceed.
Chief Judge Orr, Judge Harney, and Judge Rome, I am Skip Morgan. I have been who you all were, except not quite so grand digs back at Bowling Air Force Base, and it is good to be back doing this again. All of us who have ever been in the military justice system have heard, much to our annoyance, the old saw that military justice is to justice as military music is to music. I always took offense at that and rankled, and as it happens, just 1 week ago at a bar association meeting, I had somebody say just that to me upon finding that I had spent a career in JAG. And I always take sharp issue with that, because even F. Lee Bailey stated that the UCMJ and the military rules of evidence and the rules for court-martial provided the fairest system of criminal justice devised on this planet. And I honestly and earnestly believe that. But F. Lee Bailey said that before the enactment in 1994 of what became Military Rule of Evidence 414. There are three issues that the court has specified for oral argument, and I'm going to not necessarily treat them equally, because it seems to me that the first two are kind of subsumed together. The first, whether the military judge erred in admitting evidence of previous uncharged acts of sexual molestation by appellant towards ANS and ANN without the necessary findings of logical and legal relevance. And then the third issue, whether the military judge abused her discretion in admitting poster-sized photos of both the charged victim and her two sisters. And last, whether the military judge abused her discretion in failing to disclose Brady evidence and consisting of the mental health records of ANS, ANN, and STN. Way back when, in the Neolithic age, when I was in law school, I had a law professor who subsequently came to the Department of Justice in civil litigation, who made a very important point for me in advocacy, and that was this. He referred to advocacy as a 90-10 rule. 90%, he told us young fledgling lawyers, 90% of successful advocacy is making your tribunal want to rule in your favor, and 10% is giving them a legal excuse to do that. The theme of this case is that the government, having no evidence of anything that was of uncharged misconduct that was germane to the only issue in findings, and that was whether or not there was penetration of STN, instead put on an entire trial to depict Major Nixon as a serial child molester, and thus causing the members to dislike him. Nobody likes a child molester anyway. Nobody likes what was even charged in this case. But to make it look as though he had serially abused his daughters certainly made this case a 90-10 case. And then all they needed was an excuse. The government has overreached in this case by far its constitutional and statutory limits. And I say this with all seriousness. I try not very hard not to insult this court with hyperbole or extravagant statements or appellate cliches like absurd and misplaced reliance and so forth. But in this particular case, I respectfully submit that constitutional issues are at stake here, because Rule 414, if the trial judge abandons her role to safeguard the constitutional protections that overlay Rule 414, becomes an unconstitutional application of that rule. The facts in this case are well out of the ordinary of the sexual abuse kind of case. Richard Nixon confessed everything to his wife in 2005. He had a choice in 2005 when he was overseas, when there was estrangement in the marriage, of either walking away or staying with his wife. And he chose the latter. But to do that, he felt he had to make a clean breast of what he had done, and did, and told her that, because he had resolved that it was not going to happen again. And members of the court, it did not happen again. The underlying supposition of 414 that the child abusers or child molesters are recidivists of the worst order, at least in this case, was not borne out. There were no more incidents. He pled guilty in this case to every single charge but the rape. He exposed himself to 18 years of confinement without even the rape being, without conviction for the rape. And yet the vast majority of this trial was consumed with the testimony and Major Nixon's forced requirement to actually address the issues brought up by the other two sisters, was consumed in over 700-page record with the uncharged misconduct. Of the record on findings, on the crucial issue of whether he actually penetrated STN, something that she, by the way, denied up through the Article 32 investigation, on that critical issue, 4 pages. This wasn't a mini-trial on uncharged misconduct. This was the trial that the government put on. And the guilty pleas was not part of a pretrial agreement. Major Nixon pled guilty to everything that he possibly could plead guilty to, save the rape. What were these uncharged acts? And I want to kind of narrow in like a laser on this. In the government's answering brief, it states, Major Nixon had, quote, digitally penetrated the vagina of his daughters. That has a clear and obvious connection to his penile penetration of another daughter. Now that statement says unequivocally there was penetration of his other daughters, plural, which would prove penetration of the other daughter charged, STN. Patently and unequivocally false. There is nothing in the record to that effect. That is a foul at the trial level, and it is a foul at the appellate level, and it is more a foul because the government never took it back. Were this true, then indeed the relevance portion of the government's argument, the 401 portion, which must be incorporated in the 404, would be true. What is the actual misconduct in this case? With ANS, it was spooning her fully clothed in 2001, putting his hand down her pants, but she was careful to say and repeated there was no genital contact, certainly no penetration, but in her, quote, crotch area. And then spooning her again, fully clothed, in 2003. I would suggest respectfully that spooning does not qualify as an act of child molestation through the clothes by any measure. There was never a question of an erection in this case. So under 414, we don't even have an offense of child molestation. With ANN, touching her breast in 2003, that certainly qualifies. Awoke to find him lying on top of her, never mentioned by ANN. To the OSI in the original statement that was produced for purposes of the divorce, that one was a total surprise in trial, not disclosed by the government, pursuant to 414B. That was brand new for Major Nixon to defend himself against in this case. And that he spoke with her in a shower, not an offense under 414 and under Yenny. So I want to make a correction. At page 24 of our assignment of error, we state that we won't waste the court's time on whether the various acts would be, if true, an act of sexual molestation. In view of the clear holding of Yamine, that there must be a specific enumerated crime, it's hard to see how speeding through clothes with no evidence of an erection or talking to a daughter while in the shower could ever qualify.
Where does 120 come into this, sexual conduct?
I would suggest, Your Honor, that spooning through clothes, all he was doing was lying alongside her, did not constitute sexual contact. And sexual contact, remember, through clothes is different than without it, because through clothes there must be an intent to arouse the sexual passions.
In 120?
Not in 120, Your Honor, in 414, the enumerated offenses under 414.
Oh, I understand that, but if you walk back from 414 and you look at 120, wrongful sexual contact, doesn't matter whether it's through the clothes or not.
If it is intended to arouse or gratify the sexual desires of somebody or to harass or humiliate, there's no evidence of that, Your Honor.
Why do most people spoon?
I won't say that I've spooned with my children, but I certainly have cuddled up with them on the couch. I would not suggest that that was sexual. But apart from that,
I mean, you used the word spoon. That's why.
Pardon me?
You used the word spoon. I didn't say cuddle. Why do most people spoon?
I can't answer why most people spoon, Your Honor.
But is it reasonable that it would be to gratify sexual desires?
It is reasonable. There was never any proof of that at all.
Well, who's to make that decision?
Well, I think...
Does that amount to arousing and gratifying sexual desires? Is that no fair judge? Do they have to make a decision, or is it a question of weight for the members?
I think it's a question of weight for the members, Your Honor.
So it's a piece of evidence for them to consider, like anything else, for which argument by defense counsel could be this is nothing more than a father cuddling, hugging his child.
It would be, Your Honor. But really, this detracts from my central point, that under any circumstance, none of this uncharged misconduct went to the only material issue on findings. And there was only one. Not the propensity to molest. For heaven's sake, he had pled to that in his pleas, and he actually talked about it in front of the members. It was the question of whether he had gone beyond that and penetrated STN. And as to that, there was no evidence from either of the two sisters of penile penetration, digital penetration, or any kind. That was the only issue on findings.
Well, did the acts have to be similar? Did they have to be the same act?
The acts must be relevant, Your Honor, to a material fact at issue. That's what they have to be relevant for. Otherwise, the relevance argument goes away. If it is so that relevance is established merely by showing acts of propensity, you wouldn't have the third leg, that they must be relevant to some independent material fact at issue.
Okay, let's go back to the first leg then. 414 says that any sexual act or sexual contact with a child prescribed by the UCMJ. Okay?
Fair enough.
Why doesn't spooning fall within that parameter to the point where you can at least consider it for propensity?
Okay, granted.
Okay, now, move on.
Okay.
That's, I want to make sure that at least for you, you acknowledge or did acknowledge that 414 is...
And certainly with respect to fondling the breast and the hands down the pants, there's no argument there.
Okay.
The thrust of this argument is that we never get to the second through the third and the fourth leg. The government has yet to show the relevance of this other misconduct to any issue on findings. And it certainly has never shown that there is any balancing act because, balancing protocol, because relevance is not established.
Well, the military judge thought it was relevant, didn't she? And we're not understanding the balancing act, putting that aside, but with respect to her limited findings, did find it was planned in preparation of intent in her written findings.
It was her written findings simply rehearsed the qualities of relevance, but never suggested. I mean, how is in spooning with the daughter, planned preparation intent for penetration, and by the way, this happened afterwards. All of these things happened afterwards. We have an unusual situation of somebody who allegedly committed rape 10 or 11 years ago and then had progressively diminishing acts of sexual molestation thereafter. But the point is... Pardon me?
For propensity evidence, does the timing matter?
No, it does not. Not according to... We know that's true. But it is important to understand that in the case in which the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces said that, it was talking about things that happened afterwards that were also charged in this particular case and were part of the charge sheet. Rule 414, with all due respect to the way this came about, never came about the way ordinary rules of evidence come about. It was part of a congressional enactment in 1994. It was in response to the acquittal in part of William Kennedy Smith. And it was a very popular political thing to do. It did not go through the U.S. Supreme Court. It did not go through the Judicial Commission. What is extraordinary about 414 is that the judicial conference that was called upon to review it unanimously condemned 414 and 413 as being contrary to our whole system of jurisprudence and requested that the Congress consider rewriting it. The only dissenting vote came from the U.S. Justice Department and the person that drafted it in this case under then Attorney General Janet Reno. My point being this, when Wright was written by this court, or by the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces, when it was written, it very carefully did what the Tenth Circuit and other circuits did, and that was to say, in order to be constitutional, there must be protections, among which was the 401, 402, and the 403 analysis. And that's what didn't happen here. The military judge's decision with respect to relevance was simply circularity. It was, it's relevant because it's propensity evidence. That doesn't get us there. Because if it's relevant because it's propensity evidence, then all sexual conduct comes in. Period. And that overlooks the critical point that it has to be relevant to a material fact at issue on findings. Every one of the cases that we have seen in this case, all of the precedents were for people that pled not guilty to the kind of conduct that was brought in. He pled guilty to that. There was ample evidence in this particular case of propensity to molest. For heaven's sakes, he pled guilty to it on several instances.
How could the prosecution argue that with spillover instructions? How could they argue propensity based on his pleading of guilty that because he pled guilty to charges 1, 2, 3, he's also guilty of 4 and 5? Which is what I seem to be hearing you say is because he pled guilty to it, he has a propensity, and one should have argued that and not the daughters coming in and testifying about what they said occurred to them on prior occasions.
Your Honor, our appeal is on the basis of the misconduct with respect to ANS and ANN. There was also uncharged misconduct that came in with respect to STN. We are not disputing that. We're not arguing that that was error to let that in because it is very clear that it was not error to let that in, particularly since there was an allegation of digital or attempt to digitally penetrate STN. It's the other two, Your Honor, that the government started this case with. Without any clarifying instruction, the case opens when the only issue is whether he raped STN with this catalog from two other witnesses. What is a jury to think about that? Without the kind of clarifying analysis that goes into it. The judge's instruction with respect to relevance was for any issue for which it might become relevant. Well, that's not very helpful. Members sitting there can't possibly help but think that propensity evidence is good and relevant because it shows character. This guy's a bad character. Therefore, we should believe that he also raped his daughter, STN.
But the military judge instructed them they couldn't use it for that purpose, didn't she?
They could not use it.
That instruction.
Your Honor, they could not use it alone for that purpose. You cannot convict on propensity evidence alone, but yet that was really all they had. Four pages of this record.
Well, you had the SDN testimony that this occurred.
Your Honor,
obviously
she did.
It wasn't alone. I mean, this is the evidence that came out from the young lady herself as to what she said occurred in the bathroom and in the bedroom. So it wasn't by itself being convicted solely on the testimony of the two other sisters.
And I'm not suggesting that it was. There was only four pages, I'm saying, of evidence on the penetration from SDN herself. The two sisters added nothing to that except to smear him, which kind of brings us around full circle. We didn't talk about the prejudice versus probativeness, but the probativeness, I would suggest, if any, is close to absolute zero Kelvin in this case because there's no evidence of the penetration. That was the only issue on findings. But beyond that, there is the prejudice. For heaven's sakes, we have this guy being tried. And the trial counsel helped with that by continually referring to sentencing him for everything that he had done. There was to be justice for these three. The very thing that was condemned by the court as clear error in Schroeder. It was clear error in Schroeder. The only reason that it wasn't reversed in Schroeder was because it was not plain error and there was no objection. Major Nixon certainly and unequivocally objected to what happened and to all of the introduction of this evidence. There is no 403 findings at all in this record. I would respectfully suggest that there was no relevance finding either other than the circular argument of this is propensity evidence. And then a 404 analysis, not a 414 analysis, to show plan or design of what? Plan or design for penetration, for rape? Both of the other sisters deny that there was ever any, that he was ever even unclothed with them, much less that there was an erection or anything else in their case.
What standard do we apply with respect to the judge if we determine she did not do a 403 balancing test? How do we review it on...
Well, there's no deference. I mean, when there's no evidence of it, there are no record of it, rather, no deference is to be afforded, and that's clear in our cases from the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces.
And I ask that simply because Edinger seems to say specifically when the judge fails to do a balancing test, it would be less deference.
Yes, sir.
Versus a man which has no deference. But Edinger coming later on, do we apply a less deferential standard, or do we apply no deference to the military judge?
I would suggest that there is no deference to be made because there's no finding. There's nothing to which you are to defer. And on that basis, as I say, I think it's very hard to get to anything other than the fact that this was prejudicial. The point being this, and this is important and probably the nucleus of everything I have to say, and that is if this is relevant, if this case shows that you can bring in uncharged misconduct, as happened here, that does not go to the crucial issue of trial, and for which there is other less prejudicial evidence to wit his guilty pleas and the fact that he admitted to doing all of the other things with STN, then, with all due respect, what such evidence is not admissible? Where do you draw the line? Because I do not think the government can come up with, and they should be asked this, they come up with a situation saying, if this is admissible, what isn't? What principled, disciplined way do you have to say this is not relevant to a fact? You read out number three and number four under the right test, because propensity evidence would then always be relevant. Under no circumstances would it not, regardless of pleas, regardless of the other evidence, regardless of the availability of less prejudicial evidence in this case.
Well, Rule 414 is an expectation that it's going to come in favor of admissibility.
It does, but with those constitutional protections clearly intact. And Yemen says that because this thing is kind of a reversal of 600 years of Anglo-Saxon jurisprudence, the trial judge stands as the gatekeeper in this case. And when she abandons that role, we have a constitutional problem. Because there is a very real probability in this case that Major Nixon was convicted because of all of this other evidence. Recalling that STN, on the question of penetration, and I keep coming back to this, up through the Article 32 denied that there had been penetration, denied there had been touching of the vaginal lips. It's only a perfected case by the time it reaches the court-martial itself. So the evidence is not overwhelming by any stretch. And so this piling on of two other sisters, the use of big photographs, poster-sized photographs, of all three of them having no relevance whatsoever, how can a photograph be, as the judge ruled, propensity evidence?
Well, let me ask you about that. Is your objection to the photographs themselves, or is it the size of the photographs, or both?
Both. I don't care if they were little thumbprint snapshots showing, and they, by the way, were displayed in this particular case, showing as they did three pictures of little girls in the sixth and seventh grade when adults are testifying on the stand to show propensity stretches credulity. And that's the basis under which they were brought in. What relevance were those photographs, other than to continue to remind the members that there were three girls, and he was on trial for three girls. He wasn't. And he shouldn't have been.
Can I go back to the main issue that you brought up so far?
Yes, sir.
The penetration. I don't want to mischaracterize or misunderstand what you're saying. Are you arguing, what would have happened if the two sisters had come in and said he had penetrated both of them? Would that then have been relevant under 414 with respect to this case?
Absolutely.
Good. Does the prior misconduct then have to be the same with this conduct?
No, Your Honor. The prior misconduct has to give the members some relevant evidence that as to a matter at issue. Which is why I would concede, had the government been accurate in saying, and this, by the way, is all the government has ever said in terms of argument, they have always premised the relevance of this on the fact that he had penetrated the other two daughters. That's in their brief. Take that away and there's nothing left of relevance. I would not be here had there been penetration, digital or otherwise, of the other two daughters, and that's what they testified about, because that goes directly to a relevant issue on findings. But that's not what happened.
So it was reaching down the one daughter's hands and touching her breasts, being through the shirt, is not relevant with respect to the charge of the murder.
Correct. And remembering that in ANS's case, or ANS's case, reaching down the pants, she denied vaginal contact. She always denied that there was actual genital contact, much less penetration. And that's important.
And just to be clear, I'm talking about the other sisters, the one that says he reached down her pants, the older one.
Yes, sir.
Reached down her pants and touched her pubic area. You're saying that would not be relevant if that was the evidence coming in?
I am saying that.
Just making sure I understand exactly what.
And remembering that the military judge in this case let everything in. Everything. The shower, everything. The failure to disclose evidence, I have just a couple of minutes in this particular case. The government, again, incorrectly argues to this court whether or not that evidence would have been admissible. And that really begs the question. The question is not whether it would have been admissible. The question is whether it should have been disclosed in the first place. And disclosure enables the defense to make up its own mind about where we ought to go, with credibility of the different witnesses. And it also allows this court to review a record in which those arguments are made and the basis for the judge's decision one way or the other. Is available for the court for review. In this case, we never knew about it because it simply wasn't disclosed.
All right. Assuming that it should have been disclosed, what difference would it have made? Because that's what we have to evaluate.
Returning, Your Honor, to the only question on findings having to do with the credibility of STN. recalling that through the Article 32 she denied penetration. Through the Article 32 she denied that penetration. This was a razor-thin case, and where we had evidence of, I don't want to say dishonesty, but of the possibility that 11 years ago there was also something going on with her older brother, that can raise the defense of mistake. Would it carry the day? I don't know. The court deliberated for 8 hours on the only issue in this particular case, penetration. And so I would respectfully say that, yes, it makes a difference. And because it is Brady evidence, this court must be persuaded that it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt in this case.
To clarify for me, the statement that STN allegedly made in those records was made to her mother. It wasn't made by STN to her therapist, right? So we're talking about a statement that she made, allegedly made, to her mother, who represented that statement to the mother's therapist. It didn't come from STN to her therapist. So it's kind of removed in time a little bit. Right?
It is indeed, Your Honor. That would, of course, go to weight, but at least the defense should have the opportunity.
I just wanted to make sure I understood.
Well, the other one, just to make sure there's no confusion, it's important that ANN...
same thing with her, right?
...was the one who denied to her mother that she had ever been molested, and yet came to court and said, essentially, that she had been.
But again, in that case, the statement was made... ANN said one thing to her therapist, and her mother represented to her therapist that ANN said something else, right? So is that what you're getting at?
No, ma'am. This is actually a separate situation where ANN, the second daughter, the little daughter, who came in and testified about laying on top of her, that had never come up before.
I'm talking about in the mental health records, the disclosure of
what I'm sorry, Your Honor. Yes, it is. It was once removed in the mental health records. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right.
Chief Judge Orr, Judge Rohn, Judge Harney, good morning, and may it please the Court, I'm Captain Brian Mason, and along with Mr. Roger Bruce, we represent the United States in this matter. Now, we're here because appellant pled guilty to repeatedly molesting his youngest daughter, starting when she was about 10 years old, and also because he was convicted of raping her on diverse occasions. Now, before the trial, the military judge reviewed mental health records with regards to all three daughters, as well as mom. And then during the trial, the military judge properly admitted evidence under MRE 414, and properly admitted evidence of the photographs of all three of the daughters at the age when each was being molested by the appellant. I'd like to spend my time primarily on the admission of the 414 evidence. So talking about that first, the military judge properly admitted this evidence. And I want to address an issue brought up by appellant's counsel in his brief and again here today. When he says that in page 12 in his brief, quote, there is no finding or analysis at all under MRE 403. Then here in argument today, he says that there are no 403 findings in this record. That is not a correct statement of what's in the record. Specifically, I refer the court to Appellate Exhibit 8, which is the military judge's written rulings on this issue. Military judge made a oral announcement of her ruling at page 27 and 28, but that wasn't a full analysis. Appellate Exhibit 8 is her written findings. And in that, if the court looks at paragraphs 10, 12, 15, and 16, those all go to her analysis in MRE 403. She did conduct a 403 balancing test. That test was placed on the record in her written findings, and the military judge is entitled to full deference under United States versus Mann's.
Counsel, you would concede that she didn't use the words, I find this relevant, I've done a balancing test, probative value versus prejudicial value. I mean, you would concede that she didn't use that terminology.
Certainly, Your Honor, but what she did do is she weighed the same elements that are articulated with regards to the unfair prejudice, with regards to the elements specifically articulated in Wright as well, and I'll lay those out specifically in just a few minutes, if I may, but specifically in 1516, she did that analysis as required. And Judge Harney, you're right. She didn't say under MRA 403. But the analysis is there, Your Honor, and she's entitled to full deference.
I mean, the lawyer just doesn't state it in her ruling specifically. Why are we supposed to look for that? That's what we're doing deference. When she puts it on the record, I completely before the rebounding test, I determined that the substantial prejudice is, you know, all of that. She didn't do that. She didn't use that word, so why am I having to read into her finding that she did this test, which, as the appellant said, is very important with respect to constitutionality of 414.
Yes, Your Honor. I understand your question, but I don't think you need to read into her written ruling in order to make the determination that she did, in fact, do this 403 balancing test. If you look at paragraph 16 of Appellate Exhibit 8, she specifically says, there is little danger of distraction to the fact finder. Presentation of the evidence will not be unduly lengthy. There is a close proximity between the charged and uncharged acts, as well as the relationship between the parties. So we have a specific findings and conclusions of law with regards to 403 and 413.
Actually, it looks like she just basically summarized the right factors and put them in paragraph 16.
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely. And that includes 403 as well. And we know that she's doing that because on page, the previous page in paragraph 10, she specifically acknowledges MRE 403 and states that although relevant, evidence may be excluded if its probative value is substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice, confusion of the issues, misleading the members. She's specifically acknowledging MRE 403 and then applying the factors in paragraph 16. So I think the analysis is there in Appellate Exhibit 8, and she is entitled to full deference under MRE 403 in her ruling there.
If we decide otherwise, what standard do we use? Same question as Mr. Morgan. Is it no deference, less deference?
Well, Your Honor, as you brought up in United States versus Edgar, which is the later case by our Superior Court, it does say less deference. But we would assert that even if you applied no deference, Your Honor, the result is the same. This evidence is clearly admissible, and she made the correct ruling in admitting all of this evidence. Specifically applying the right factors, as mentioned earlier, essentially what appellant is arguing is that because there wasn't 414 evidence of rape, that they shouldn't have been admitted on this case of rape. Well, that's not the standard. Under MRE 414, it's acts of child molestation in cases of child molestation. If we look at the definitions, rape clearly falls in the definition under MRE 414 as child molestation being a sexual act, specifically referring to sections D1 and E1 of the rule. Defines what a sexual act is, and rape is clearly going to fall within that. So the charge, he's charged with an act of child molestation. With regards to these other acts of child molestation, they are also going to fall within the definition listed under MRE 414 under sections E4 and F as sexual acts by touching the genitalia or as sexual contact. So,
all right, now assuming all that, why is this relevant?
Well, Your Honor, it's relevant into two different issues. Appellate defense makes the argument that, well, there wasn't an issue of whether or not he penetrated the other daughters, or that was the only issue in the case. Well, the issue in this case is whether or not he committed an act of child molestation. So there's inherent propensity, which in United States versus James, our Superior Court recognized specifically. The court said, so-called propensity evidence is therefore relevant in cases of sexual assault and child molestation. So that's the first part of it.
All right. But we already assumed that part. Why is it relevant in this case?
Beyond that, Your Honor, the relevance in this case is not only to show that he did molest STN, but also how. If you look at the specific language about how he carried out these different molestations, they're very similar. From the standpoint of several of these occasions began while the daughter was asleep, and they woke up to find they were being molested, whether it was appellant feeling their chest, or was down their pants, started that way. And then he would use comments similar to, oh, I was just checking if you were just pregnant, or I just want to see how much you're growing down there, or, oh, do you have breasts, or something to that effect. So this, the language and how he's doing this, and the military judge specifically found with regards to this evidence that it goes to opportunity, plan, preparation, knowledge, and intent. And I'm referring to paragraph 16 again in her written rulings. So it's also relevant to show not only that he did, but how he did commit the molestation in this case.
Can you speak to the morning point with respect to the government's assertion that there was digital penetration?
Yes.
I couldn't find that record.
Yes, Your Honor. And when I got a chance to get assigned to the case and took a scouring look at the record, essentially what we have with regards to the two daughters, meaning A and S.
Two sisters.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, the oldest sister and then the charge victim, STN. Essentially, there's two issues there that were 414 evidence. First is with regards to A&S in 12 September of either 1997 or 1998. She woke up in the middle of the night to appellant's hands down her pants, feeling her vagina.
Could you cite to where in the record that is?
Yes, Your Honor. That's at 191 in the record when A&S was testifying in findings. And so he talks about appellant's hands down her pants and her feeling her vagina. She doesn't talk about specifically penetration in there. So that's one potential area of penetration. The other area is with regards to STN, where she says, and this is at record side 251, in January 2001, STN, when she's about 9 or 10 years old, testifies that she felt her dad, appellant, licking her vagina. Specifically, she says, she felt his tongue moving around like between the lips. So those are the two instances beyond the charge rape that I was able to locate specifically in the record that relate to penetration.
Did the government counsel, the trial counsel, make a representation to the military that digital penetration took place after August? Therefore, this is relevant evidence of the
414
as to why you should come in as propensity evidence for the charge
of defense of rape. Yes, Your Honor, I believe that's correct.
Is that a misrepresentation. That's a pretty big one if it wasn't, because that may have been part of the military judge's decision to do whether very inflammatory evidence could come in to the August doctor.
Well, yeah, I'm certainly not going to stand here and say that the trial counsel misrepresented the evidence. I did not interview any of these witnesses. He did. So it would be hard for me to say that he didn't make a reasonable assertion based on what he anticipated the evidence would be. The evidence as it actually was presented in the record at page 191 with regards to A&S is that appellant's hands were down her pants feeling her vagina. Whether that at some point came into, well, I felt him on the outside, I felt him on the inside, I felt him around, I don't know, Your Honor. What I know is what's in the record at 191, and that could easily have been a catalyst for the trial counsel providing that representation to the judge.
Okay, assuming that they had known that the testimony was going to come out and there would be no evidence, direct evidence of digital penetration, would the evidence of the spooning and the touching of the vagina, the other things that the sisters talked about, would that have still been relevant under 414?
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely. Because we're not, as Judge Rohn, you mentioned earlier, the 414 evidence is, I don't want to say presumed to be admissible, but it is not often that a 403 analysis should keep it out, and it's certainly a strong legislative intent to admit this type of evidence. And that's specifically referenced in United States versus Wright when the court talks about on 482 of the opinion. It says, it's not expected, however, that evidence admissible pursuant to the proposed rules 413 to 415 would often be excluded on the basis of MRE 403. And as we look down at, back to U.S. v. James, it recognized that to page 221 of the opinion, where the Congress and the President, their adoption of Federal Rules of Evidence 414 and MRE 414, have decided that evidence of other sexual acts of misconduct is admissible to show propensity evidence to gauge that type of sexual misconduct. So we have that strong legislative intent to admit this type of evidence. So regardless of whether there was actual penetration of these other daughters or of STN on other occasions, that's not the standard for admissibility. Certainly that could go to weight, But under MRE 414, it's still admissible because it meets the definition of child molestation as defined by sexual acts, sexual contact, and the like in sections E and F, D, E, and F of the rule. So those are all going to be relevant there and admissible. The other piece I want to refer the court to is on page 340 of the record. Civilian Defense Counsel is making an opening statement to the members. He specifically says with regards to the relevance of the 414 evidence, he says, quote, there is some relevance to those that I do think is important for your consideration. That is, none of those acts even approaches the act to which he is pleading not guilty. Well, obviously, as the court is aware, relevant evidence not only could go to showing that something is more probable, but also less probable. Well, the Civilian Defense Counsel at trial is essentially asserting in his opening there that the evidence, because of this lack of other rape evidence, that it goes to show that he did not rape STN. Again, more evidence that it's relevant. The military judge properly applied the right factors and found that this evidence was relevant. She found that the evidence of the prior acts to be extremely strong. She found that each of the girls lived in the family home, were roughly the same age when appellant inappropriately touched them, that the acts were committed when no one else was around or were asleep. Appellant used the same type of language to the girls, as I mentioned earlier, and with regards to two of them, he asked them to keep it secret. Further, like U.S. v. Tanner, which is cited in our brief at pages 450 and 451 in the opinion, the alleged acts and the prior acts involved the same family and the same general time frame, and with regards to the same age as well. They were all appellant's biological daughters, and the acts occurred frequently with ANS and STN and once with ANM. And as the military judge found, there was not an undue amount of time needed to prove these other acts. There was a total of two additional witnesses at trial, just the two other daughters, to show the multiple 414 acts were committed. Now, I want to address one of the issues that appellant brings up, which is regards to, well, there's other less prejudicial evidence available because they could have just replayed the care inquiry. Ironic argument, given that at trial, Civilian Defense Counsel argued that they should not play back the care inquiry. In fact, you can find that at pages 330 and 331 on the record. Bottom line, though, there was not less prejudicial evidence available because he wasn't charged with the acts with regarding ANS and ANN. So those were not available in the care inquiry. The least prejudicial evidence was available. It was presented through the daughters, and that was appropriate. And I want to make one other point clear as well, which is the members were properly instructed with regards to how to use this evidence. If you take a look at the record at pages 544 and 545, there's standard bench book instructions that the military judge used with regards to 414 evidence. And additionally, kind of backing up, the military judge, after ruling on the motion in limine, specifically invited both parties to present specific instructions. And she came back at page 530, after the ruling, she did that at record page 29, so you can see that there. But later, at 535, she asked again, any parties have any special instructions? And appellant did not have any. Did not ask for any other special instructions with regards to how to use this evidence. The standard bench book instructions were obviously fine, and they were. They were fine, they were appropriate, this evidence was relevant, it was admissible, it was properly instructed on. And where the military judge properly applied the correct law, did a 403 balancing test, placed it on the record in her written ruling, and provided the appropriate instructions, this court should be hard-pressed to find any facts and circumstances that were a clear abuse of her discretion. Unless there's further questions on that issue, I'd like to move to the issue of the mental health records.
All right.
Issue 6 deals with the non-disclosure of certain mental health records. And essentially, appellant argues that there are two records. I know it's encompassed in probably about three documents, but essentially two records that should have been disclosed. First, regards to STN, essentially in May of 2009, which is just a few months before trial, where apparently she tells mom that when she was a child and her brother was 10 years old, that she, her, the brother, the older brother, tried to sexually touch her. Well, in appellant's brief, he specifically argues that, well, this should have been disclosed because it would have happened around the same time frame, and they could have argued confusion or mistake with regards to the brother versus the father. Well, that premise falls apart based on a misreading of the record. The record does not say that it happened when she was 10 years old, which is the charged time frame that occurred around the rape. It specifically refers to the older brother being 10 years old. So we're talking about a big difference here. And if we look at Volume 3, which is the report of investigation, is in that portion of the record in Volume 3, you have the 1168s for BNN and STN, and you compare the birth dates. You can see that when the older brother is 10, STN is 5. So you're talking about something completely different, 5 years earlier at best. Okay, and a 5-year-old is very different from a 10-year-old.
Well, why do you get out? And why do you get from the defense? I mean, the question that is always difficult is trying to divine the intent of the defendant's theory of the case. Why shouldn't you just get this evidence and then when it comes with a proper instruction that you cannot release it? And then when it comes up to the admissibility question, have the normal conversation that goes with any piece of evidence, you know, none of this is not admissible. Why don't you keep it away from the defense? We don't know where they're going. It may affect their ability to go with a particular theory of the case. Seems like that's the problem here. We're going after the fact, deciding what would have been helpful.
I understand, Your Honor, but the standard is that the evidence for it to be disclosed has to be relevant or material for the preparation of the defense.
Then how do you know that? How do you know that? I mean, you can say that now because of the way it played out. Defense counsel would like to have a piece of evidence to decide what to do at that time.
Well, Your Honor, it is a difficult question. There's no doubt. But the military judge, in her wise experience and deference, has this evidence in front of her and made the decision not to disclose it because it wasn't relevant or material to the preparation of the defense. And as we know what the record is, now we can see why. It's not relevant material. How could something, when she's 5 years old, essentially what they're arguing to is that there's a confusion between brother and father 5 years earlier.
What about the potential inconsistent statements made between the other sisters to the mother who then related to? I understand there's double hearsay in all of that. But
with
respect to potential inconsistent statements, that would seem pretty potentially relevant, wouldn't it?
Well, Your Honor, with regards to STN's record, with regards to this allegation, accusation, I guess, remembrance that brother may have sexually touched her, I don't know that there are any other statements beyond just that one. So we don't have an inconsistent statement with regards to that record. I think what you may be referring to, Your Honor, is the record with regards to ANN, where there is the statement, which is the second record that appellant defense sees that they, or argues that they should have received. Essentially, in that record would be ANN, a couple months before trial, essentially reports to the counselor that she's out drinking, doesn't really remember what happened, essentially blanked out, and at that point, she wakes up with a friend's brother who she believed was engaged in sex with her. She has bruising and bleeding. And then a couple weeks later, about 3 weeks later, and just a little over a month before trial, she tells mom essentially that she was out, male acquaintance spikes her drinks, and then they engage in sex. Again, bruising on her back as well. Even with that, Your Honor, though, certainly some additional detail, but there's not inconsistencies there. Appellate Defense Counsel characterizes that as an untruth and a considerably different story. Well, I would disagree, Your Honor. I don't think that there's anything that you could reasonably look at and say, well, the fact that there was an additional detail or lack of additional details in others yields to an untruth or a considerably different story.
How would the military judge know that? That's what I'm saying. This is the difficulty I have in keeping out records from the defense that says you don't get to see this evidence because I assume you're not going to need it.
I understand, Your Honor, but we have a standard for a reason. We don't just give the defense everything. There's you know, the privilege under 513 that protects certain things, and unless they can show that It is relevant and material to the preparation. They're not entitled to that evidence.
But how do they know? I mean, when you go back in camera and you look at it, how do they know what I'm looking at?
Well, the defense obviously does not know, Your Honor, but the military judge is making that determination. You know, this is not a military judge. He's new to the bench. You can see from the record when they're talking later in the trial, I believe it's just after the sentencing piece. The military judge had been on the bench for 6 years. So this is an experienced military judge who's seen, obviously had seen lots of trials. She had the decision to make that it, whether or not it was relevant or material, and in fact it wasn't. And with regards to the, even the explanation here today, and in appellant's brief, with regards to STN's record, the entire premise for which they say they were entitled to that record falls completely apart because they misread it, because it was when the brother was 10, not when she was 10. So clearly, that is not a record they were entitled to. With regards to A&N's testimony, and it really just to kind of sum this all up with regards to the mental health records, it all relates to the standard. Would this have been resulted in a different trial? Because we're all talking about materiality. Would this have resulted in a different outcome? Does it shed this trial, does it undermine the confidence in this trial? Neither of these things would have done that. If you apply the standard that's laid out in Roberts, that's what we're talking about here. Now, when you're talking about STN, essentially their argument is that she was mistaken or confused. Well, you can look at her testimony and see. She testified in detail that she was lying in bed with her brothers, and the dad shooed them out. So there was no confusion between who brother was and who dad was. She testified unequivocally that dad kissed her on the mouth, put her hand on his penis, then told her to keep it secret. Then she testified that appellant laid her down, pulled her underwear off, and she felt his penis thrust in between her lips of her vagina. It wasn't confusion, there was detail. So that would not have made any difference whatsoever in this trial. With regards to Ann's testimony, clearly her testimony on the 414 evidence was admissible. Okay, it met that standard. But if we look at how this played out at trial, the impact of A&N's testimony was minimal at best. Because if you look at the record, she testified about the one incident where dad essentially was spooning with her, or excuse me, that was A&S, where she woke up and dad was feeling her breast while she was sleeping. Okay? So she testifies to that. The appellant testifies on findings and says, I touched A&S, I touched STM, but I never touched A&N. Never touched her. Well, during the assistant trial counsel's sentencing argument, he argues to the members, appellant lied, he lied to you. Objection by defense, sustained. Military judge instructs the members, there is no evidence before you that the accused lied under oath. So after the assistant trial counsel's sentencing argument, he then says, they're having an Article 39A session. And the assistant trial counsel says, well, I forgot to ask for the mendacity instruction. The military judge says, I would decline to give it because, quote, I do not feel that the accused lied under oath. And that's at page 761 in the record. So there's this issue that obviously the military judge did not believe he lied under oath. There's really no evidence that the members believed it either. And they didn't have to because they had all that evidence of A&S if they wanted 414 evidence. But more importantly, they had all the evidence from STN. That was the person they needed to believe and obviously did when they convicted him of the rape specification. So kind of bringing me back around to my point is A&N's testimony, the record whether or not it was disclosed regarding her, whether she had this issue on the prior sexual assault, incapacitation, drinking, had sex, whether that record was disclosed or not would not have affected the outcome of this trial. There is no reasonable probability, and that's what we're talking about here, reasonable probability, not a reasonable possibility, but a reasonable probability that this would have been different. In fact, the United States Supreme Court specifically addressed that at page 291 of their opinion in Strickler v. Screen. It's not a reasonable possibility. It's a reasonable probability that the outcome would have been different, and it wouldn't have been here. Now, unless there's further questions from the court, I'd like to talk briefly about the admission of the photographs.
Go ahead.
Yes, sir. Now, the military judge did not abuse her discretion in admitting these photographs. The pictures were relevant. I provided a supplemental citation to the court last week regarding United States versus Combs. And essentially, this court has acknowledged that both the prosecution and defense can properly admit victims' photographs for a specific evidentiary purpose, such as establishing victims' identity, size, apparent physical condition, or to help the court formulate an accurate mental picture of the circumstances of the offense.
Why couldn't they do this on 8.5 by 11?
Your Honor, I can't speak to that, but what I can tell you is, obviously, this is a member's case, so perhaps they didn't. And ultimately, let me back up. Ultimately, they did do it on 8.5 by 11, and that was sent back.
They did both. That was.
Yes, Your Honor. But certainly, in order for the members to see, we could logically conclude that they wanted to have the picture there so everyone could see it at the same time they were talking about it. The important thing to remember about that, though, Your Honor, is these are not pictures of injuries, of them actually engaged in the molestation that appellants subjected them to. These are not inflammatory at all.
So what did they do? What was their purpose?
Well, Your Honor, their purpose is to show the similarities between how they looked at the time. If you look at Prosecution Exhibits 1, 2, and 3, you can see, especially Prosecution Exhibits 1 and 3, which is ANS and STN, look very, very similar. So that's one very highly probative aspect of that, because it goes to the probative value of the 414 evidence. It's not 414 evidence in and of itself. Of course it's not. And, you know, appellate defense provided yesterday, U.S. v. Yameen, that's not what we're talking about here. We're not talking about just admitting the photos themselves. It is probative of the 414 evidence. So, taking a look at those photos, I mean, these are yearbook photos, regular school photos. There's nothing inflammatory about them. Military judge properly admitted those. It was not a danger of unfair prejudice. They were not inflammatory. And in fact, as this court recognized, it's not often that victims' photographs are going to yield this inflammatory. And if I could just finish my thought and briefly conclude, and I notice I'm out of time.
All right.
There was nothing inflammatory about these photos. They were properly admitted. And the military judge in this case properly exercised her discretion with regards to all three issues we've discussed. She properly admitted the 414 evidence. She properly admitted the photographs. And she properly denied releasing records that were not material in preparation of the defense. And appellant's assignments of error without merit should be rejected. And we respectfully request this court to affirm the findings and sentence.
I'm not sure where we are in time, Your Honor. Do I have the...
You had asked for five, and I delayed it, so you have. I'll give you five more.
Thank you, Your Honor. I won't even take that much, I hope. Oops, maybe longer. Your Honor, briefly, very able appellate trial counsel made the best argument that could be made under the circumstances, but declined to accept the rhetorical challenge to actually tell us why or how this evidence was relevant, because propensity is only the second leg. That is to say, you have to be charged with a sexual molestation charge, and there has to be evidence of other sexual molestation. That's one and two. He never gets to three, and that is the relevance. If the appellant had not pled guilty to the other acts of molestation relevant
against STN. Because now we do have something to show propensity for something which is at issue. Did he molest her? But he did plead guilty. If there had been any evidence of penetration in the other ones on the only issue at trial, relevant. But when both of those are zero, not relevant. Trial counsel didn't really explain the pictures, just said that they were relevant. Relevant to show what? Well, first of all, they were brought in under 414 to show propensity. I would suggest the prejudice in this particular case is that those three poster side pictures sat right in front of the bench during the entire trial. The clear intent of the prosecution to say, he's on trial for three girls here. We have three victims. The trial counsel referred to all three of them as victims. He wanted justice for all three of those girls. That's the prejudice. The very prejudice that the whole issue of 414 comes to. He was put on trial for all three girls and only charged for one. As to the issue of penetration, we must be very clear in this case. A.N.S., who was the oldest daughter, specifically under oath at the trial denied that there had been penetration, digital or otherwise. She denied it. The judge in Appellate Exhibit 8 never found that there was penetration in these other acts whatsoever. The penetration the trial counsel refers to in this particular case was a penetration of the digital penetration and the oral penetration of STN, not the other two girls. And we're not objecting to that. We understand that it does meet the relevance factor in this case, making an a fortiori case that the others are not. Counsel suggests the rules arguments in establishing relevance, but that's not germane to this case. The specific recitation of STN to the rape itself had nothing to do with I'm just trying to do something else in the bathtub. And anyway, he had already admitted to that, and she had testified to that in the other charged acts of misconduct. Everything he needed by the way of propensity evidence, every rationale behind it, was satisfied fully both by his plea of guilty and the fact that STN, the other issue, some of which was uncharged misconduct, was brought in, and we're not objecting to that.
But how does the members know what the objection to Garenberg is being replayed during the finding? How would they know what the facts were that he pled guilty? Because they could use that as a propensity evidence because he pled guilty. They didn't know any of the facts.
Well, and the point being that the facts came out through STN's own testimony.
The government's not limited to that.
But, Your Honor, I'm not objecting, okay, in this case, to STN's testimony or that at all. I'm not suggesting that was error. I'm suggesting ANS and ANN was error.
But you also claim that the government essentially could have used the testimony over the fact that the accused had pled guilty as evidence to support the other charges that were still in dispute.
But, Your Honor, there were no other charges in dispute.
The rape.
The only charge in dispute was penetration and the rape. There were no issues in dispute about molesting STN. And we're not suggesting that the uncharged misconduct with respect to molesting STN, such as the oral sex, was not admissible. It was. The problem was that this whole trial was against, and shown by the prosecution to be against, three different sisters. Never been answered. What material fact at issue on findings was made more or less likely by the testimony of ANN and ANS, and I would respectfully suggest there was none. Finally, the military judge's 403 simply rehearsing 403 as she does and says 403 requires this without actually applying it to the facts in this case is no 403 analysis at all. Thank you very much for your time, Your Honors. I appreciate it.
Before you sit down, just to make sure I'm clear on this, you're not asking us to find 414 unconstitutional, are you?
I would not be so presumptuous, Your Honor. Tempting though it might be, I am saying it is unconstitutional as it was applied here without the constitutional protections that Wright insists are in there.
All right. I just want to make sure I understand.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. We definitely found them to be very helpful. There being no further business for this court at this time, court is in recess until 13:30.
All rise.